Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al Fayed, Predator at Harrods.
Cash, with that you can control people.
Nothing comes for free.
Listen now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm Paul Henley. President Biden has today announced a surge in assistance to Ukraine, including nearly $8 billion of military aid and new long-range munitions ahead of a White House meeting with President Zelensky. That comes just days after Mr. Zelensky announced what he called his victory plan. Whether it's all enough to defeat Russia remains to be seen. Following a brief news conference with President Biden, Mr. Zelensky met Vice President Harris, and she spelled out afterwards why America was right to stand by Ukraine.
And history reminds us, and history is so clear in reminding us, the United States cannot and should not isolate ourselves from the rest of the world. Isolation is not insulation. So then, the United States supports Ukraine not out of charity, but because it is in our strategic interest. We will continue to provide the security assistance Ukraine needs to succeed on the battlefield, as demonstrated by President Biden's significant announcement earlier today.
The BBC's Jenny Kumar is in Washington, D.C. I asked her if there was still a shortage of detail on the so-called victory plan.
Yes, in fact, no details about that. It was mainly kind of pleasantries, really. President Zelensky said he was grateful for the aid that had been announced today, some $8 billion and some more weapons. We expect them to discuss this victory plan. We don't know the details so far, but it's expected to basically include a continued request for long-range missiles to be used, or permission for those missiles to be used to hit military targets deep inside Russia. And also some support for the idea that any ending of the war will include Russian withdrawal and Ukraine regaining territory that Russia had occupied. But I think there's two main issues for President Zelensky's at this precise moment. It's the lack of troops, the shortage of troops he's facing as we look ahead to a normally bitter winter in the Ukraine, and also the possibility of a Donald Trump government, which could mean less support. The dilemma for President Biden, he's been very cautious about granting that permission for Western-made missiles to be used against targets deep inside Russia, cautious about that then escalating conflicts, bringing NATO members in direct conflict with Russia. Indeed, yesterday, President Putin, he said that any nuclear power that supported a non-nuclear power in attacking Russia, he basically issued a renewed, a fresh nuclear threat to anyone involved in that type of movement. Now, President Zelensky has, in the past, when these kind of comments have been made by President Putin, said that basically he is saber-rattling. But it seems to have had the desired effect to a certain extent in terms of President President Biden being cautious, although he has in the past rode back on some of those concerns around so-called Russian red lines.
Jenny Kumar outside the White House. How will news of this deal be received in Ukraine? What do people there think of Mr. Zelensky's victory plan? The details of that plan have remained secret still. There is added urgency, though, given the uncertainty of November's US election. The BBC's Jessica Parker reports now from the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv.
This White House meeting is probably the climax of a week of diplomacy for President Zelensky in the US. News that further American military aid is being sent to Ukraine will be welcomed here, as overnight, Russian missile and drone strikes continued, including here in Kyiv. This is the Pechersky district of Kyiv, and after last night's drone attack, here I can see blocks of flats with a lot of broken glass, broken windows, cars that have been pierced by shrapnel. And all across this little neighbourhood now, people are clearing up once again. 31-year-old Mariana is stood outside as they sweep the debris away, her two-month-old daughter strapped to her chest.
I woke up to the sound of the drone. I got up and saw the reflection in the windows, how a big ball of fire was falling down. A fragment flew into our window, breaking the glass. Fortunately, miraculously, it didn't hurt the child who was sleeping there.
With President Zelensky presenting what he's calling a victory plan to leaders in the West, I ask Mariana how important Western support is to Ukraine's hope of fending off the Russian invasion.
I believe it's not possible we achieve that on our own. We need help from any countries, absolutely. Otherwise, we will not win.
I also ask 68-year-old Natalia if she believes victory is possible for Ukraine.
I don't know, but my close friend is fighting, and several more friends are fighting. Of course, they know better at the front, but they are not in the mood to surrender. They are fighting and not going to leave, run away from the front line or demobilize.
Despite the resilience of Ukrainians, there's a general recognition they need Western support, which depends not just on President Biden as he prepares to leave office, but also whoever comes next. A meeting between President Zelensky and Republican nominee Donald Trump, who's again hinted this week he could curtail support to Kyiv, now appears to be off, while some Republicans have criticized the Zelensky camp for what they see as partisan behavior, with just over a month to go before the US election.
Jessica Parker ending that report and highlighting that President Zelensky's visit and his itinerary have sparked outrage among some in Washington. There were already clear signs that were Donald Trump to win November's election, he could cut funds to Ukraine. Yesterday, the Republican Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, sent President Zelensky a letter in which he demanded the immediate removal of Ukraine's ambassador to the US for organising what Mr. Johnson called a partisan campaign event in a battleground state when President Zelensky visited Scranton, Pennsylvania. Tim Burchett is a Republican congressman for Tennessee and a member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. What was the Republican position, I asked him first, on the latest big aid package from the US to Ukraine?
Well, I can't really speak on behalf of the whole Republican Party. I can speak on my behalf.
Sure.
I think we've thrown too much money at it. I think there's a lot of questions that remain to be asked. We're over $160 billion, I think, now. It just seems to be never ending. And now the president is doing it without congressional support. And President Zelensky has basically joined Vice President Harris on campaign stops at taxpayer expense. So there's a lot of problems we have with what's going on right now.
And you support Mike Johnson's demand for the removal of the Ukrainian ambassador, do you?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I think that's a good start. But I think we need to curtail our funding of this war. I think it's going to be a never-ending war, and I think that it's Americans need to start minding our own business. I think it's Europe's war. Let Europe fund it.
You know President Zelensky has what he calls a victory plan. Obviously, you do not believe Ukraine can win?
I don't know if they can win or not, but that's not, it's not our war. America is funding this thing. We are the top financier in all of this. And I don't know what our goal is in all this. You have Russia, whose GDP is somewhere between Canada's and France's. And we're borrowing every dollar we have to give to Ukraine. I just think our priority should be on our own country. Our economy is going downhill quick. The average American is paying over $600 more a month out of pocket just for groceries to survive. And I think we need to focus on our own folks.
If Ukraine or large parts of it do fall to Russia and President Putin is emboldened, an invasion of another European country, say this is a European war, if, say, Poland is invaded by Russia, then it definitely is America's war, because, of course, under NATO rules, you'd have to join it.
Well, again, NATO, a lot of the other European countries haven't been paying under their full NATO dues.
And for that reason, you want to rewrite the whole constitution of NATO, the whole rule book?
No, it's not our war. At what point are American boys and girls going to be fighting in this war? I don't see any clear path one way or the other on this thing. I think it's mired down like Afghanistan was for Russia and Vietnam was for America. And I say this could be a very long war, drawn-out war. Currently, in the past, we've been paying pensions for people in Ukraine when we have our own veterans living under bridges. So, again, it's not our war.
And just remind us of Donald Trump's policy on Ukraine. Would he pull the plug on altogether on funding?
I don't know if he'd pull the plug altogether, but I think he'd have a plan to get us out of it.
And the plan would be what?
I don't know. I said I think he would have a plan, but I guarantee you it wouldn't be bankrupting our country.
It would presumably mean making a peace deal with President Putin, and that would be constructive, would it, from America's point of view?
I think if it would stop the war and stop the killing, I believe it would.
And the American position would be that, a peace deal as soon as possible, were Donald Trump to win the election.
I don't know. I don't know if that's the case or not. I haven't spoken to President Trump about that, but I don't believe this war would have started or it would have continued as long as it has if Trump had been in the White House. I believe he would have negotiated some sort of peace. We didn't have this problem. We didn't have the problem in Gaza, and the terrorists were in fear for their lives.
Donald Trump called Mr. Zelensky the greatest salesman in the world. He has persuaded the U.S. to hand over a lot of money so far. It's all been a con, has it, from your point of view?
No, you're putting words into my mouth, and that's what you all in the media do. If you want real answers, we ought to sit down at the table and discuss it, but it's not going to be that. It's going to be you all pointing the finger, and the American taxpayers will be funding this indefinitely, and people are getting rich off of it. And I find that reprehensible.
Republican Congressman Tim Burchett, who represents part of Tennessee and who also sits on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, explaining his dissatisfaction with the status quo in U.S.-Ukrainian relations. You're listening to the BBC World Service live from London. This is NewsHour. Coming up later, the Democratic mayor of New York, Eric Adams, has been charged with taking bribes and illegal campaign contributions. The local district attorney outlined the seriousness of the allegations in a news conference today.
Public office is a privilege. We allege that Mayor Adams abused that privilege and broke the law. Laws that are designed to ensure that officials like him serve the people, not the highest bidder, not a foreign bidder, and certainly not a foreign power. These are bright red lines. And we allege that the mayor crossed them again and again for years.
We'll hear the latest from a reporter who's been following the case. One other headline for now. The US says a proposal for a ceasefire in Lebanon was coordinated with Israel, despite Israel's insistence that strikes against Hezbollah must continue. I'm Paul Henley with NewsHour, live from the BBC. 10 years ago today, in Mexico, 43 male students from a rural teachers' college disappeared, having been forcibly abducted in Guerrero, in what has been called one of Mexico's most infamous human rights cases. Today, families and supporters have been rallying in Mexico City to demand justice, despite extensive investigations revealing state collusion with organised crime. Only three of the victims have been identified. Outgoing President López Obrador has labelled the incident a state crime, but he denies military involvement. Our correspondent Will Grant is in Mexico City, and I asked him to explain more about what was being commemorated.
Well, in essence, Paul, you touched on it there. It is one of the most emblematic human rights violations in Mexican history, certainly in modern Mexico, arguably in modern Latin America. The name Ayotzinapa, where this tiny student-teacher college is based, will forever be synonymous in Mexico with the disappearance and supposed murder of the 43, and the fact that a state forces are believed in independent investigations to have been involved alongside organized crime, and B, that it's never been solved, that they simply do not know where the vast majority of those bodies lie.
Tell us about the demonstrations today.
Well, as you can imagine, they're gathering in what is essentially the centre of Mexico City. They're hoping to walk to the presidential palace itself, the National Palace, make their point very, very clearly that they feel let down by President López Obrador, a man who said as a campaign promise he would leave no stone unturned in this investigation, who has called it a state crime. But during his administration, the independent investigators had to abruptly leave Mexico, saying they were hitting a number of official obstacles when it came to looking at the involvement of the military, and something that he says is simply not the case, that the military were involved. He agrees that local forces may have been involved, but doesn't believe that it goes any further than that. The thing is, for the families, they may get no further than a certain point on their route, because the barricades are firmly up and there is a big, big police presence.
The new president-elect says she is seeking accountability. How hard a task is that?
It's huge, I think, because what has been lost in this decade is any sense of shared ground, common ground between the López Obrador administration, indeed the party, the governing party, Morena, and the victims and their supporters. I think all goodwill has been lost over these years by the fact that the victims' families who've kept up their fight for justice simply feel they've been pushed back, they've been taken in one direction, pulled back in the other, lied to their faces, and they feel let down by successive administrations, the Peña Nieto administration under whose watch this horrific situation took place, and the López Obrador administration who promised to solve it.
Will Grant there, reporting from Mexico City. Now, most tourists hope for sun and blue skies when they visit England. Not so the Impressionist painter Claude Monet, when he came as the 20th century was about to begin. He wanted to capture London's grandeur, though, through the smog that engulfed the city at the time. The resulting series of paintings were exhibited in Paris and cemented his reputation as France's leading artist of the time. Now, London's Courtauld Gallery is recreating that exhibition, with many of the paintings reunited for the first time, a wish of Monet's that was never realised in his lifetime. Nicola Stanbridge reports.
About 125 years ago, Claude Monet arrives here at the Savoy for several months to paint nearly 100 canvases of the Thames looking up and downstream through a heavily industrialised, sooty, smoggy, atmospheric London landscape. He was fascinated by what he called the delicious fog. He told a journalist that London's more interesting, that it's harder to paint. The fog assumes all sorts of colours, black, brown, yellow, green, purple fogs, and the interest in painting is to get the objects as seen through all these fogs. Jackie Wulschlager, author of Monet, The Restless Vision, how did Claude Monet choose his view of London?
Well, Monet arrived in 1899 after quite a traumatic period in France, and he wanted something absolutely new and different. The Savoy was the latest word in modern hotels. The bridges that he saw, I see as his bridge to the 20th century. There was Charing Cross Bridge, the horizontal, modern, gleaming, metallic rail bridge on one side, and on the other, the much older Waterloo Bridge with its cavernous arches.
Let's go and see his choice of view. So here we are in one of the suites, bedroom to our left, and a living room to our right. But the living room he would have used to store all his canvases.
Oh, to paint in. He made the sort of studio he had at home. And there he stood at the window, waiting for the changing light effects.
He also wants to be outside painting. He's on a balcony here. Describe his actual process.
Monet is a very early riser. He's up there with the dawn. Large brushes, visible brush strokes, importantly, many, many canvases, all of them on the go at the same time. He painted looking down. He wanted what he called the magnificent breadth. So he wants a panorama. Vehicles going across Waterloo Bridge, which was not the bridge we see now. It was the old 1817 bridge. So he had the cavernous arches and their reflections set against the South Bank with all its chimneys and industrial stacks. The industrial smog and the steam. He wanted the excitement of being able to sort of see through it and sort of not. And that's really what we get and why they are so mysterious. He crosses a river, he goes to paint the Houses of Parliament, painting from the top of the roof of St. Thomas's Hospital. And there he's painting really sort of day becoming night, that moment of velvety darkness descending.
In all weathers?
Oh, he never thought twice about his safety like that. And of course, what do you know? He did end up with pneumonia. And he was stuck in the Savoy for 3 weeks, unable to move. His appetite was legendary, so that didn't stop.
Is that the first time you've seen that view?
It's the first time I've had the pleasure of being up there exactly as Monet was. And I think it's remarkable to see what he saw and then see what he did with it.
So 37 out of his 100 paintings would go on to a show in Paris in 1904. And we're going to go and look at 18 that are being brought together here in London. His intention was for them to be shown in London. So why has it only happened now?
It didn't work with his dealer and Monet was disappointed. But it's a very exciting moment. And the fact that this show is taking place in the Courtauld, which is so close, it is very magical. You're walking into a man's vision of London on all sides. The London Paintings was the first really immersive show. If we look at these incredible Houses of Parliament, we see how he's playing with colour and he's playing with light, and he knows he can do anything, and that's why it is so fantastic to see them all together, because it is like a symphony orchestra. Each one contributes its bit. And Monet was criticised for the first 20 years of his career. People said, it's slapdash, you're just painting an impression, what use is that? And when he puts the impressions together, suddenly it is understood.
That report from Nicholas Danbridge here in London. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.
Money talks, and it gave him the power to manipulate people.
This is a story of power and control at the very top of British society.
It seemed like he really cared for me, wanted to look after me, almost in a fatherly way.
How Mohammed Al-Fayed, then owner of the luxury department store Harrods, groomed, isolated, and attacked young women who worked for him.
He had done this for so long.
And now, they refuse to be silenced.
I would have to enter his private office on my own. That's where things would start to happen.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Scientists in China say they've discovered the world's oldest known cheese from 3,500 years ago. They analysed dairy samples found with Bronze Age bodies buried in the Xinjiang region of Western China and found fermenting microbes from kefir cheese. My colleague Fuchsia Dunlop is the author of Invitation to a Banquet, The Story of Chinese Food. Given that cheese isn't a staple of Chinese cuisine, was she surprised by this discovery?
Well, not really. I mean, I think what this highlights is that Chinese cuisine has always been very multicultural and shaped not only by ancient indigenous traditions, but also by contact with people from, you know, in this period of time and the early dynasties, with people from the Northwest. So across North China, you still see the legacy of contact with all these nomadic peoples to the north and the west. And yeah, very interesting. I mean, still within Chinese borders, you have Uyghurs, Tibetans, Kazakhs, Kyrgyz, and they're all people who have dairying traditions and who eat various kinds of dairy food.
But not the prevalent culture. So what happened then?
Well, so for a long, many parts of Chinese history, there were eras and there were areas where people did have a dairying tradition. So there's a very famous 6th century agricultural manual, which has a whole section on keeping cows and sheep and making things like yogurt. And during the Tang Dynasty, more than 1,000 years ago, the upper classes ate something like ghee, clarified butter and various kinds of yogurt and cheesy foods. But in the later dynasties, yes, it sort of became a very minority thing and largely died out by the end of the Qing dynasty. So in China today, there are pockets of very fascinating cheesemaking. So, for example, in Yunnan province in the southwest, the Yi people, that's one of the minority groups in this very diverse region, they make a goat's milk cheese, which is very like Indian paneer, a sort of simple fresh cheese. And another group in Dali in Yunnan province makes something a bit like mozzarella, where they're stretching the curds and then sun drying the cheese. So you have these little pockets of cheese making, but it never really caught on. I think what's really fascinating is that the Chinese didn't really need cheese because quite early on they started using the soybean, which is very protein rich and offers a similar sort of series of amino acids to those, you know, essential for human nutrition.
And can be fermented, and also to give, you know, that sort of richer flavour too, right?
They fermented soybeans to make things like the ancestors of soy sauce, fermented beans with these rich umami flavours. And then from at least 1,000 years ago, more than 1,000 years ago, they were making tofu. But the thing that's so interesting is that the technology of making tofu is terribly like the technology for making simple cheeses. You know, you have a milk, in this case, a bean milk, and you coagulate it. You know, cheese is in Europe is mostly coagulated with rennet, an animal enzyme. But in China, they use gypsum mineral salts and things to coagulate the soybean. But you end up with something that looks quite cheese-like. So the Chinese perhaps didn't really need cheese in the same way.
Fuchsia Dunlop, BBC producer and author of many books on Chinese cuisine. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Paul Henley. Now, today saw a large explosion in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. The Israeli military said it had carried out what it called a precise strike, killing one of Hezbollah's drone commanders. This comes after the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, dismissed international pressure for a ceasefire and said strikes against Hezbollah in Lebanon would continue until victory was achieved. The Lebanese government says well over 600 people have been killed on its side of the border since Monday. Speaking in Munich, the US Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, urged both sides to agree a truce and to enter talks.
A full-scale war between LH and in Israel could be devastating for both parties, and it could lead to a larger conflict throughout the region. That's not in the best interest of anyone. The best way forward is to pursue a ceasefire that will enable diplomacy to take place.
In the meantime, the number of refugees trying to get out of Lebanon and into Syria is growing rapidly despite the ongoing civil war in Syria. Hours-long queues have been building up on the border of over 30,000 people desperate to escape the Israeli strikes on Lebanon. Suher Zakut is a spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross in Syria, and she has witnessed the scenes on the border.
We arrived to the border early afternoon, and we've witnessed the influx of people coming, crossing the border between Lebanon and Syria, women, children, elderly people, using cars, buses, and even there are some were walking on the crossing, next to the crossing point. They were tired, elderly people were looking for safety, children were crying, mothers were trying to calm down their children. A mother told us that the most difficult thing is to decide to leave your country or to leave your memories, to leave the place, your home, the only place you have known in your life. The International Committee of the Red Cross, together with the Syrian Arab Red Crescent, were there yesterday, also today, seeing with our own eyes what is happening and how people are crossing, what are the needs. And today we started distributing water bottles. Assessment of the needs of the families is going on. And by the time we are reaching a point to see how we can better help the Syrian Arab Red Crescent. But you know, it's the trauma, the uncertainty, what the future have for them, the tiredness, the exhaustion. It was so difficult.
Suher Zakut of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Syria. So is there any route left to a ceasefire on the northern Israeli border? This morning, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu dismissed an American-led proposal for a 21-day pause in fighting, despite the US saying it had coordinated the plan with the Israelis. David Schenker was US Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs between 2019 and 2021, during which time he mediated between Lebanon and Israel on drawing up their maritime border. He is now a senior fellow at the Washington Institute think tank. I asked him why Israel would have agreed to a deal in private and gone on to reject it publicly.
Well, there have been misunderstandings before, or Israeli change of heart in the intervening time. Of course, one of Netanyahu's cabinet ministers said he would bolt from the coalition if the deal for a ceasefire or a temporary truce was signed. But it's hard to understand, but I think this is not the first time since October of last year that this kind of thing has occurred.
Is there any way in which a peace proposal can be workable, given that the Israeli government says there'll be no let up until total victory?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's total victory in sight with Hezbollah in Lebanon. This is an enormous, well-equipped Iranian-backed militia.
Well, the history of their conflict definitely suggests that victory is difficult.
Yeah, victory. I think what they're looking for is really a degradation of Hezbollah capabilities and ultimately to get to a situation where Hezbollah's Radwan special forces are off its border, that there is a buffer zone that is not in northern Israel, but is in south Lebanon, filled on that side of the border, not by Hezbollah, but by the Lebanese armed forces. That's what the U.S. Special Envoy, Amos Hochstein, has put on the table and tried to negotiate for the past 6 months, and what Lebanese Hezbollah has essentially refused to deal with until then.
You've worked with both sides, as I mentioned, on agreeing to draw up their maritime border. What do you think Hezbollah's end game here is?
Well, at this point, it's saving face. The organization was created by Iran in the early 80s to basically serve as a deterrent to Israel. That is, it would prevent somehow Israel from targeting either the Iranian regime or its nuclear program these days. Hezbollah is content with conducting its war of attrition against Israel. There are 70,000 Israelis off the border, displaced from their homes. Israel wants to get to this deal. I think Hezbollah's end game is to try and have this linkage between a Gaza ceasefire and an end to Hezbollah's attacks on Israel. That's nowhere in sight. And in the meanwhile, Iran doesn't want to see Hezbollah degraded in a way like 2006, that it took 5 to 6 years to rebuild the force.
Israeli attacks on Hezbollah communication devices, the rocket attacks now, a possible ground invasion by Israeli troops. In your opinion, does the self-defense argument by Israel entirely hold?
Well, of course, Israel was attacked, unprovoked attack.
That's not disputed, no.
Yeah. No, what I'd say is that they're still not getting to a understanding with Hezbollah, and they have done that in the past, like back in 1996, an understanding about where forces are based, what the array of forces is, and what the ground rules are in the interactions between Hezbollah and the IDF. Israel needs to get to a situation where there cannot be these Hezbollah special forces within 1 kilometer of the Israeli border. October 7th, Hamas carried out its invasion and attack on Israel. This is exactly the same war plan that was Hezbollah's war plan. And so Israel post October 7th is not going to return to the status quo on that border. And whether by force or by negotiations, it's going to change the status quo.
David Schenker in Washington, D.C. The Democratic mayor of New York, Eric Adams, has been charged with accepting bribe money following a long-running investigation that sent the largest U.S. city's government into turmoil. Adams faces 5 criminal charges, including conspiracy to commit wire fraud. Prosecutors said he sought and accepted benefits, including luxury travel, from wealthy foreign business people and a Turkish government official. Speaking at a news conference, the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Damian Williams, said Mr. Adams had broken the trust of the people.
The conduct alleged in the indictment, the foreign money, the corporate money, the bribery, the years of concealment, is a grave breach of the public's trust. Public office is a privilege. We allege that Mayor Adams abused that privilege and broke the law. Laws that are designed to ensure that officials like him serve the people, not the highest bidder. Not a foreign bidder, and certainly not a foreign power. These are bright red lines, and we allege that the mayor crossed them again and again for years.
So how serious are the charges? I've been speaking to Craig McCarthy, who is City Hall Bureau Chief for the New York Post.
The mayor is accused of bribery and wire fraud, as well as dealing with foreign countries to solicit bribes into his campaign. The charges are federal charges. He faces up to 45 years if convicted on this 5-count indictment.
And how would you sum up his response?
He's been defiant. He's saying he's not going to step down, and he's alluded that this is a targeted attack on him for being an outspoken Democrat in the city who is, you know, pushed back against the federal government and their handling of the asylum seeker crisis in New York City.
He's the first mayor in New York City history to be charged whilst in office. So it's quite a historic thing, isn't it?
Yes, this is an historic moment. He's the first sitting mayor to be charged with any crime. And we're just trying to figure out day by day what this actually means for the city, because this puts us into a lot of uncharted territory.
And how realistic is it that he can just carry on with his job while facing such grave charges? He says he won't resign.
So there's only 2 ways he can be removed from office. Right now, who can remove him is the governor, Governor Kathy Hochul, who is also a Democrat and has been an ally of the mayor in the past. There is a legal process that has to take place on that, though, and the case law on that is slightly murky because it's never been done before. Now, there is another way where in the city, a committee can be formed to remove him. But again, these are things that have never been done before.
Tell us a bit more about Eric Adams. Was he, at least until now, a popular political figure?
So Eric Adams started as a popular figure. He ran on the platform of reducing crime in New York City, which was a very big issue across the United States coming out of COVID. He ran on bringing New York City back on the economy, bringing the city back to what it was pre-COVID. Now, when he was in office, he was popular for a bit. You know, he had the honeymoon phase, but as crime continued to rise under his leadership and a lot of other scandals came through and his disagreements with the city council, his approval ratings have dropped to near historic levels.
Judging from his news conference, he has some fairly vociferous supporters still.
He does. He is rallying the support of his community, the people that his base, to come with him. Sources inside his camp have told us at the Post that he is getting loads of support from people that are friends, family, supporters, other lawmakers. But again, it's still unclear on if that is going to be enough to keep him in office.
And there are several federal corruption probes underway. Could there be more charges brought against him?
Correct. So Damian Williams said today, that is the U.S. Attorney of the Southern District, he had noted today that this investigation is still ongoing. Now, this indictment comes 3 weeks after the police commissioner's home was raided, as well as four other top officials in Mayor Eric Adams's administration. However, those are just the probes we know about.
How will the whole scandal affect the running of such a major city?
I mean, he said he's going to keep his head down and continue running the city. What the problem is going to become is this has become a political problem for him. He has to work with other people. He has to work with the council, other lawmakers. He has to work with unions. And if they don't believe that he's going to be in office next year, they might not be willing to work with him. That's going to be the challenge. And that's going to be the question that he keeps getting asked is how is he going to run one of the biggest cities in the United States while under federal investigation with others still looming?
That was Craig McCarthy reporting from New York City. You're with the BBC World Service. We're live from London. We're in NewsHour. I'm Paul Henley. This is NewsHour. Next month, we'll see commemorations across Israel, marking 1 year since the October the 7th attacks. More than 1,200 people died. Well over 200 others were taken hostage when Hamas gunmen crossed the border from Gaza, killing indiscriminately. They attacked many dozens of sites, including kibbutzim communities, army bases and the Nova Music Festival. BBC Storyville has been speaking to some of those who survived. Some of the disturbing material used was recorded by Hamas. My colleague James Menendez has been speaking to the documentary's director, Yariv Moser, and another of the survivors from the Nova Festival, Ben.
Very closely to what happened on the 7th of October, there were already denials and conspiracies on social networks. I was there on the site of the Nova massacre. I saw it in my own eyes. I was determined that this truth about what happened should be out there as a piece of history, as a documentary film that will remain.
Did you feel also that it was a year on in danger of being forgotten to some extent, especially given all that has happened in the nearly 12 months since?
Oh, definitely. I think the world moved on. And of course, the war is still going on, unfortunately. The price is high on both sides, but people need to remember where it all began.
And what is extraordinary and particularly harrowing, of course, is that much of the footage that you use is from that time. It's mobile phone footage. I mean, how did you gather all that up?
So amazingly, those survivors had the feeling that the necessity to use their own cell phone and capture the moments. At the same time, I was keen to have the footage that was captured by the perpetrators themselves, the terrorists. They each had a GoPro camera and they were documenting the atrocities.
Let me bring in Ben, who's come in today too. And you were filming on that day. Can you remember why you decided to switch on your phone camera?
I remember that this is my first video. I'm running on my life. And Just I realized that something like this never happened to us. I live in the south. I know what is like they send rocket to us and I need to go the fast as I can to the shelter. But something like this with a lot of terrorists, even then, I didn't know there is thousands. In this moment, I realized this is something that never happened. And these videos and these photos, it's going to worth a lot. The one video, I was down the tree. And this moment, I realized that, yeah, there is possible that I'm going to die. And this is going to be my last video.
Was it hard participating in the documentary, reliving what happened? I mean, it must have been very traumatic.
Look, everybody in this case is very traumatic about all the situation. It's not obvious to speak about it here. It's not obvious to speak on TV and the news. It's really hard because I tell this so much time and it's hard, but I try to do my best all the time because I know this is very important to speak about it and put it out to me like traumatic that I was there and to the world that don't really understand what we've been through.
How did you manage to survive? It was you and another woman. You were essentially hiding together, weren't you?
It was very quiet, a few minutes, that like complete with the dead. I just said to myself, it's not gonna be like this. I'm not gonna stay here. I'm not gonna die. I'm gonna continue and she come with me, no matter what it takes. Yeah, remember she told me, you please don't grab me anymore. I cannot move anymore. My foot is bleeding. But I told her, it's not going to happen. You with me, and doesn't matter whatever it takes, you with me, and you're going to see your kid, and you're going to see your husband, and doesn't matter, I'm going to grab you on my back, and we're running, and walking, and hiding, and 16 kilometers that I thought is not going to over.
16 kilometers?
16 kilometers in the sun.
Yariv, you must have been aware when you were making the film of your responsibility to those taking part in it and giving their testimony. How did you deal with that?
Well, we took some time. We didn't open the cameras just after the attack. We did some research. I met a lot of survivors and decided who is capable enough, mentally capable, to sit in front of the camera and bravely talk about what happened to him. I had a psychologist on the set with me to accompany the survivors and talk with them after the interview to see that everyone are okay.
And Ben, you talked about telling the story, retelling the story. I mean, has that process of telling the story over and over again, I mean, does that help you process what happened?
Absolutely right. I realized to get out from this trauma is to talk about it, to let it out with family, with your friends, not keep it in your heart. I remember a lot of my friends that in this moment after the festival didn't talk with anybody. And this is like a conflict between you and yourself. And no one know what you've been through.
And is it difficult, this is a difficult question, but is it difficult trying to process the fact that you survived and others didn't?
Yeah, Yariv, how it call it?
Survivor's guilt.
Yeah, survivor guilt. And when you think about it, yeah, it's hard. It's hard, like, why me? Why not him? He's more good than me. You have a lot of questions and hard questions because you're in this life, you're alive, and they not. We realize the life is worth a lot.
Yariv, I think you said that it's not a political film, but it was a national trauma, wasn't it, for Israel?
Oh, of course. I think that the film is critical towards the Israeli government as well. It is hard for Israelis to watch it. We are still seeking answers from our government. For one thing, I think the film strongly is saying Hamas is a terror group that I differentiate from the Palestinian people. I really hope for reconciliation, for peace between the two nations. But this is not what Hamas is seeking.
To end, hopefully on a more optimistic note, I mean, the film is called We Will Dance Again. What optimism, what hope can you find, Ben?
Party is one of the best things that I do in my life. I'm a DJ and producer, and this is my life music. And it's so hard to right now go to the party and just think about people that not here. It's hard. But I see the people that not with me, and I'm dancing for them.
And that documentary forms part of a group of programmes marking 1 year since the 7th of October attacks. Another BBC Storyville, Life and Death in Gaza, will be broadcast in October. Thanks for listening to NewsHour. Goodbye for now.
NewsHour has been a download from the BBC. To discover more and our terms of use, visit bbc.com/podcasts.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.
Money talks, and it gave him the power to manipulate people.
This is a story of power and control at the very top of British society.
He seemed like he really cared for me, wanted to look after me, almost in a fatherly way.
How Mohammed Al-Fayed, then owner of the luxury department store Harrods, groomed, isolated, and attacked young women who worked for him.
He had done this for so long.
And now, they refuse to be silenced.
I would have to enter his private office on my own. That's where things would start to happen.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.